On this edition for Sunday, October 10th, the coming debt ceiling votes facing Congress, protecting the rights of LGBTQ seniors looking for safe housing, and why this man is running every street in Cleveland, Ohio.
Running these streets, you can still see a lot of the original infrastructure and really the history of the city.
Next on PBS NewsHour Weekend.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, Bernard and Denise Schwartz, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein family, the Anderson Family Fund, the estate of Worthington Mayo Smith, Leonard and Norma Klorfein, the Rosalind P. Walter Foundation, Koo and Patricia Ewan, committed to bridging cultural differences in our communities, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments.
For 25 years, Consumer Cellular has been offering no-contract wireless plans designed to help people do more of what they like. Our U.S.-based customer service team can help find a plan that fits you. To learn more, visit consumercellular.tv.
Additional support has been provided by and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
Good evening, and thank you for joining us. One more vote is needed to raise the U.S. debt ceiling when the House of Representatives returns on Tuesday, but it's an extension that will only last through December. This morning, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said she is confident Congress will raise the debt ceiling again in December, and said debt ceiling votes should be a, quote, housekeeping chore.
Once Congress and the administration have decided on spending plans and tax plans, it's simply their responsibility to pay the bills that result from that.
On Thursday, the Senate reached a deal and approved the emergency hike, which will pay the nation's bills through December 3rd. But Republican Senator Mitch McConnell has warned that he may not support another debt ceiling increase. Yellen warned today that the result of failing to raise the debt ceiling will affect millions of people. In Brussels today, thousands of protesters took part in a climate march ahead of the United Nations Climate Change Summit set to take place in Scotland at the end of the month. The protesters took to the streets, calling on world leaders to take bolder actions against climate change. About 80 organizations participated in Belgium, hoping to hold the largest gathering of climate activists since the start of the coronavirus pandemic there. Heading into the climate change conference, many environmentalists are trying to increase pressure on world leaders to do more to cut carbon emissions and mitigate global warming. The lights are back on and power is restored in Lebanon today. The country's two largest power plants shut down yesterday, plunging the whole country into darkness. The energy ministry said both plants ran out of fuel. Lebanon has frequent blackouts as it struggles with a constant shortage of imported fuel and antiquated infrastructure. In Iraq, voters cast ballots today in the country's fifth parliamentary election since the U.S. invasion in 2003. The vote was held 6 months early in response to mass anti-government protests in 2019 that saw more than 600 people killed. Groups aligned with the Shia Muslim majority are expected to dominate the election, with populist Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr's party expected to emerge as parliament's largest faction. Today's vote was marked by a boycott from activists who took part in the 2019 protests, and there were widespread reports of low voter turnout. Final results are expected over the next 2 days. Retired General Raymond Odierno, who commanded U.S. and coalition forces at the height of the war in Iraq, has died. General Odierno played a major role in the Iraq War. Referred to as the Big O, the 6'5", four-star general urged then-President George W. Bush to rapidly deploy nearly 20,000 additional American troops to Iraq in an effort to combat a growing insurgency. In 2011, General Odierno was named the Army's Chief of Staff, where he oversaw the final withdrawal of U.S. forces from Iraq. Retired General Raymond Odierno was 67 years old. For more national and international news, visit pbs.org/newshour. Representatives of the U.S. and Afghanistan's ruling Taliban government are restarting talks in Doha, Qatar this weekend. Issues reportedly on the table include terrorist groups operating in the country, evacuations, and a growing humanitarian crisis. I spoke with Saeed Shah, a reporter for The Wall Street Journal, who is in Kabul, about conditions there 6 weeks after the last U.S. troops withdrew. Saeed, right now it seems the Taliban have already started staking out positions in their conversations with the United States. They're saying that they are not going to work with or help the United States, per se, in tamping down the IS or Islamic State forces that exist in the country. And that was one of the tenets of the deal that the Trump administration struck with the Taliban, is to make sure that Afghanistan was no longer a safe haven for terrorists.
Well, the deal they struck was that Afghanistan would no longer be a safe haven for international terrorists. The local branch of Islamic State has so far, anyway, hit Afghan targets. It used to hit the former government, it used to hit the Shiite minority. Since the Taliban has taken over, it's also been hitting the Taliban pretty hard as well. So the Taliban's point of view is that we can handle the ISIS threat here.
Tell me a little bit about the situation in Afghanistan right now. You've been reporting from different parts of the country. Is the Taliban different depending on where you travel to?
There are some differences. In Kabul, you notice there is a huge amount of discipline among both the leadership and the rank and file. And they're smartly turned out in uniforms, patrolling, right, manning checkposts and so on. Further away from Kabul, most are not uniformed. And we've seen in places, for instance, that they've done public hangings, which has not taken place in Kabul. So overall, it seems that they are following orders very strictly, and you know it's the nature of an insurgent movement that they are extremely disciplined.
One of the big concerns has been the fate of those Afghans who helped American forces that are still stuck in the country. I know there are volunteers from around the country here who are still working to try to get them out.
It's very difficult to get out of Afghanistan. Essentially, the land borders are closed to Afghans, to countries like Central Asia, Iran, Pakistan. Flights are not properly going. There are a few flights which are heavily booked out and extremely expensive, unaffordable for most ordinary Afghans. And the Taliban is reluctant to see a further exodus of people.
You had also reported a little earlier about the kind of economic and humanitarian crisis that is facing the country right now as you head kind of into winter.
Yeah, it is essentially a crisis situation. With the takeover by the Taliban, international aid was cut off and the economy was entirely dependent on it. So there is growing hunger, there is joblessness, there's a lack of shelter because a lot of Afghans were displaced as a result of the war. And there are only a few short weeks left before winter really bites. The international community has pledged $1 billion in emergency assistance for Afghanistan, but it essentially has not arrived. And aid agencies are saying time is running out. The international community is extremely concerned that this money doesn't fall straight into Taliban hands. And it is worried that women will not benefit from it, or that women aid workers will not be able to work in the field. And the Taliban has not been able to give the sort of assurances that the international community wants on that.
Saeed Shah of The Wall Street Journal joining us from Kabul tonight. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's hard enough in this country finding safe, secure housing if you're elderly. Much harder still if you identify as LGBTQ. Tomorrow is National Coming Out Day, but tonight we have a story about some of the 2.4 million seniors who identify as LGBTQ going back in the closet. It's because many elderly gay and trans people fear mistreatment and abuse when seeking senior housing. The Fair Housing Act prohibits the denial of housing based on race, religion, or sex, but there is no federal law that explicitly protects people based on their sexual orientation or gender identity. NewsHour Weekend's Yvette Feliciano visited one senior housing development in New York City that is making sure their LGBTQ residents are welcome.
Stonewall House in Brooklyn is an LGBTQ-friendly senior housing development. SAGE, an advocacy organization for LGBTQ elders, which created Stonewall House, says it is the largest such development in the country. The 145-unit building, which opened in 2019, is named in honor of the 1969 uprising, often cited as the beginning of the modern LGBTQ rights movement. 71-year-old Deidre Nottingham was one of the first to move in.
I said, finally, a house for us to stay in and not be judged, you know? I've been waiting a long time, over 50 years, for something like this.
You don't have to be gay or transgender to live here. To qualify, you must be at least 62 years old and earn 60% or less of the area median income. But the fact that Stonewall House welcomes gay and trans seniors is important to Nottingham. For decades, she says she faced housing discrimination and at points homelessness due to her sexual orientation. It began at 14 when she came out as lesbian and her family kicked her out on the street. It just got worse from there.
When I was younger, me and my girlfriend, they wouldn't rent to us. And it was hard because we couldn't go back home. My family didn't want us. And it's hard when they're calling you a freak or a weirdo. I was called that lots of times by my own family members. So it's very hard when you don't have no support. And there wasn't any groups out there where you could go to. We were lost.
Nottingham says before coming to Stonewall House, she lived in 8 other residential long-term care facilities over the last 12 years. Each included some level of neglect or hostility by staff and other elderly residents.
They did not want gay people there. They always made remarks and curse at me when I came outside. So I just couldn't take it. I was afraid that they was gonna set my door on fire or something.
Were you ever tempted to hide who you were in these housing situations?
Mm-hmm. A couple times I was scared.
According to SAGE, gay and trans seniors face more obstacles than their straight counterparts. They're more socially isolated because they are less likely to have children and are more likely to live alone or be estranged from their families. And a lifetime of employment discrimination contributes to higher poverty rates among LGBTQ people over the age of 50, according to the UCLA School of Law Williams Institute.
It is truly a disgrace that there is no federal law prohibiting discrimination against LGBTQ people in housing.
Michael Adams is SAGE's CEO.
And what that means is that about half of our LGBTQ older adults are living in places where there are no such protections because there's no federal law and there's no state law.
SAGE reports that more than one-third of LGBTQ seniors fear having to recloset themselves when seeking housing due to discrimination and violence.
And their fears are real, and they're based in fact. Sadly, we hear over and over again from our elders that some of the places they feel least safe and most vulnerable to harassment and discrimination is where they live. So one of the big challenges we're dealing with is the vast majority of residential long-term care communities have no formal policies that are protecting and lifting up LGBTQ elders.
SAGE teamed up with the Human Rights Campaign to create what it calls the Long-Term Care Equality Index. It says that only 18% of senior housing communities have policies that prohibit discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity. With 29 affiliates nationwide, SAGE trains long-term care providers on how to support older LGBTQ people. This includes cultural competency, writing staff and resident non-discrimination policies, and having LGBTQ-inclusive intake forms and marketing materials.
Many of the residential communities are run by faith-based organizations. While some of them are wonderful and are embracing of LGBTQ people, some of them are not, right? So we have numerous instances of blatant discrimination where these communities simply refuse to accept people because they're LGBTQ. And then if people are accepted, there's the question of, is this an environment where I can be open about who I am?
78-year-old Stonewall House resident Bill Meehan understands more than most.
Back when I was a young man, being gay was not the thing you ascribed to be. Being gay was psychological association, psychiatric association. To them, it was a disease.
A former Catholic priest, Meehan battled coming to terms with his sexual identity before finally coming out in his early 40s.
I gave myself a hard time in just trying to be who I was. And that's a terrible journey, you know, and the idea that some people have to go back to that is just not right. This place offered an opportunity for gay people to find housing proudly. And it's not totally a gay house. It's a mixed community here. But it's a community that recognizes diversity. We celebrate diversity. And as different as we all are, we live together nicely.
Sage is lobbying Congress to pass the Equality Act, which would create federal anti-LGBTQ discrimination laws for housing. In the meantime, at the state level, it's pushing for legislatures to adopt a long-term care bill of rights for LGBTQ seniors. Deidre Nottingham has no plans to leave her one-bedroom apartment at Stonewall House because she feels safer than she ever has.
I'll be so happy when I wake up. And I haven't felt like this in a long time. It doesn't bother me being alone. I feel comfortable. I come downstairs 3 o'clock in the morning just to check my mail. That's how safe I feel. It makes me happy when I see somebody like me. It's refreshing. I'm home.
Tomorrow, about 20,000 runners will compete in the 125th Boston Marathon. It's the first time that the race is being run since April of 2019. But while the Boston Marathon was on pause during the pandemic, running alone remained a crucial outlet for millions of Americans when very little else seemed safe. In Cleveland, one resident is turning his pandemic running hobby into an ambitious project to get a better understanding of his adopted city. NewsHour Weekend special correspondent Carla Morthy caught up with him to learn more about Every Street Cleveland.
Phil Kidd is on one of his runs, about 6 miles long on average, and at a pace that would leave many weekend warriors in the dust. But the 42-year-old isn't training for a race. He's systematically running every street in Cleveland, about 3,000 miles or so, as part of a project to document and better understand this Rust Belt city.
Cleveland is a city that was built for 1 million people, but only about 372,000 people live here now, and there's been a lot of loss over time. There's been a lot of demolition. There's been a lot of change. But running these streets, you can still see a lot of the original infrastructure and really the history of the city.
For the last year and a half, Kidd has been posting his runs, along with photos and historical context, on his blog, Every Street Cleveland. It's a personal project, but one that he says informs his work as a city planner with a local nonprofit.
It gives you such a deeper context to the history of how and why certain parts of the neighborhood developed the way they did, what immigrant groups came in initially and then after and after. You can see that reflected in everything from architecture style to names of businesses and change to street names. When you're thinking about doing the type of work that I do, which oftentimes has to do with redevelopment, things that could impact longtime residents that have lived here, having that deep level of understanding in that context helps inform all those decisions that you make. So it's been really, really important.
Kidd extensively researches and plans each route in advance to make sure he doesn't miss a street or known landmark. And he tracks himself using GPS on his phone, creating a Pac-Man-like record of where he's run.
It's just a constant kind of balance between keeping my eye on my GPS, then stopping, photo documenting, turning this back on, you know, and I still got the music playing and not get hit by a car.
So. It's a lot.
It's a lot going on, yeah.
We followed him on a run in his West Cleveland neighborhood, and first stop was an old industrial building at the end of a dead-end street.
This is the old Westinghouse building, which was one of the two major industrial businesses that helped form this neighborhood.
Westinghouse used to manufacture industrial lighting here and employed more than 500 people. In recent years, a developer has proposed turning this building into a residential development. Kidd says this historical building is just one example of the kind of thing he likes to highlight on his blog.
A lot of people are going to drive on the Shoreway right down here, and they see this huge towering facade, and they see Westinghouse on top and the logos there, but they're not going to see this. They're not even going to really see the rest of that facade unless they're coming up into this neighborhood. And this is a dead-end street, so what reason would someone have to really even come down here? That's the reason why I do the blog and why I run every street, is I want to tell those stories and expose those cool things. And there's lots of this in every neighborhood all throughout Cleveland.
Telling those stories means capturing what he sees.
We can get a sense of this ornate metal artwork, but then also you can kind of catch a glimpse of the new development on the end. So it tells a story in some way.
After running past some newer residential developments and a park, which he notes the city will be redoing with community input in the next couple of years, Kidd ends up in another formerly industrial area. This one famous for manufacturing Energizer batteries.
A lot of those former industrial sites have been repurposed for new residential housing. So that's kind of been the trend here. But it still, you know, has kind of an industrial kind of feel to it. There's still an active rail line. So it's really kind of a mix of old and new.
Next up is a pedestrian tunnel under the train line with an intricate mosaic mural designed by a local artist more than 15 years ago.
And that's a map of the neighborhood and the streets we just ran through. So yeah, really, really cool.
Documenting details in the mural, Kidd notes the significance of a nondescript travel agency building that was run by the family of a former council member.
His father was the one that prevented a highway from cutting right through this area and bisecting this neighborhood during the whole urban renewal process. So it's kind of a cool little nod to them.
So far, Kidd has completed 55 runs and a total of 336 miles, which is only about 10% of Cleveland's streets. He says the length and depth of the project is part of the point. Each run exposes him and his readers to things he didn't see before.
To me, it's like seeing the Matrix. You know, you can kind of see the layers, the history, and I know what's on all the little back alleys. I know the story behind why this street is named after this person. I know how the city got the land for this park from a landfill development project that went awry, you know. All of that kind of information is really interesting, and I think when people are reading about that, they find it fascinating too.
This is PBS NewsHour Weekend, Sunday.
Finally tonight, as many of us return to our daily commute on buses, trains, or ferries, commuters in Istanbul, Turkey are riding with an unexpected fellow passenger. As one of Istanbul's ferries launches, a four-legged passenger quickly boards with commuters. After taking a seat for the ride, passengers recognize him as Boji, a street dog who seems to enjoy riding public transit.
2 months ago, we have noticed a dog trying to use our trams, our metros, all our trains, and he knows where to go, he knows where to get out. So it was quite interesting, and we have started to follow him. And it was really an interesting pattern. It's something like that. He knows where to go, and he has a purpose.
Istanbul transit officials track Boji with a microchip and says he visits at least 29 metro stations and travels up to 18 miles on a regular weekday.
No, I didn't expect to see him. I saw him on the internet previously. It was nice running into him.
Boji is a Turkish word for the undercarriage of a train. He's been spotted on the subway, historic trams, and ferries alike.
You know what? I just watched him on YouTube 2 hours ago, and I ran into him here. It's such a surprise.
Becoming a local celebrity on Istanbul's public transit, with thousands of fans on social media, Boji is also appreciated for being a courteous rider.
And he obeys the rules, you know? When the door is open, you have to let the people out first. He knows that rule very well. He waits out of the lines, just like the other passengers, and after everyone gets out, he gets in the train, and he has a special place.
That's all for this edition of PBS NewsHour Weekend. For the latest news updates, visit pbs.org/newshour. I'm Hari Srinivasan. Thanks for watching. Stay healthy and have a good night.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, Bernard and Denise Schwartz, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein family, the Anderson Family Fund, the estate of Worthington Mayo Smith, Leonard and Norma Chlorfein, the Rosalind P. Walter Foundation, Koo and Patricia Ewan, committed to bridging cultural differences in our communities, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments. Additional support has been provided by Consumer Cellular and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. And by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.